When you've got toxic work environments, you're not, no one's thinking about that. They don't care. But if you've ever worked in a toxic work environment, that impacts every aspect of your life. So they are inextricably linked, even though, you know, when we're building organizational cultures, we're not thinking more broadly about, you know, how do we want our employees to feel? How do we want them to, what do we want them to believe about coming to work, to think about coming to work, to how do we want them to act, etc. You know, when you've got toxic work environments, you're not, no one's thinking about that. They don't care, but that impacts every part of your life.
Hello and welcome to the Brand My Career podcast. I'm your host, Alex Cutterford, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. My goal is to help you take ownership of your career, find your people through personal branding and networking, and take career-enhancing action. Managing your life and career can be hard. That's why every fortnight, I'll be releasing an episode where I interview a diverse range of guests that will help you find clarity and build confidence in your career. Let's get into it.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Brand My Career podcast. Today I'm joined by Julie Cockerill, so I'm really excited to have her on, have a chat about her career journey and what she does with Lemon Co. So, yeah, history and HR leadership based in Sydney. So, Julie, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, so we'll jump in and we'll have a chat. So do you want to first share what it is that you do with Lemon Co?
I started my business about 4 years ago and my background's been really HR leadership, organisational development, change management. And so over the last sort of 4 years, I've really been taking on a number of different types of projects, but mainly in the capability transformation space. And on the side, I also do coaching, and really I focus on working with high-achieving women who are kind of teetering on that edge of kind of burnout. And generally the women that I'm working with have a neurodivergent brain, and that just happens to work out that way. But it's a great blend, which obviously suits my brain type.
Yeah.
Keeps me active.
Yeah, awesome. So, yeah, keen to dive into to understanding some of that and learning from your perspective today. So particularly, yeah, thinking in that neurodivergent space. Mm. And also I know that you're passionate about, you know, the world, you know, working differently. And so how do you... I guess, how can employers be better engaging with people that maybe are neurodiverse?
Well, look, I think the first step is always to understand what it is to be neurodivergent. So there has to be a realization initially in a business that we have a neurodiverse world. Everybody works differently. You know, we all have different types of brains formed. You know, whether it's a neurodivergent condition, whether there's some sort of trauma event, you know, whether you're raised in a particular culture. So everybody is coming to the organisation with different needs, different backgrounds, different experiences. But I think over the years, we've been really good at taking a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think what we're starting to see now is with education and you know, bringing in much more of the neuroscience and wellbeing science in organisations, that's kind of helping us to think a little bit more broadly about how people like to work. So I think the first thing is getting educated on, you know, not only what it is to be different and have different needs, and the second thing is to educate leaders on how to support people who might need to work differently. And that's by, you know, gaining knowledge around neurodiversity and neurodivergent brains, and then also actually having a conversation with the people that work for you and say, you know, what do you need to be at your best? What kind of support do you need from me? You know, how do you like to communicate? What kind of coaching and feedback do you like? How often? What's the style? You know, these are really, really good, curious questions. And often leaders are thrust into positions where perhaps they're not given the right skills or capabilities, or perhaps they're being promoted beyond capability, or they're not supported. But we're asking leaders to do a lot more, and we're not giving them a lot of time and training in order to do that. And this stuff is, it's here, it's been here for a long time. This is not new, but, you know, the conversation is really heating up, and it's in leaders' best interest to get themselves educated.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece around it's like everyone at every stage needs to be getting educated, but then also supported through. And so obviously there's a neurodivergent person needs support to work in the career that they're in their field successfully and be supported through that and having their needs met. But equally the manager that needs to be supporting them needs to be supported themselves and educated on how to actually do that. So thinking about like a practical application of, so someone maybe has been diagnosed with ADHD or something like that. What would be a practical example of a need that they might have that someone else may typically not? And what would be a way that a manager could support them in that?
Yeah. Look, I mean, that's a great question. And it is, it's very different for every person that has ADHD. And the interesting thing about having a neurodivergent condition is they typically don't come as one condition. They might come as one or two or even up to three different neurological differences. And so really typical examples would be offering quiet spaces, offering flexibility to work from home when you've got tasks that require lots of thinking, being really considerate of making sure that people can wear their headphones to block out external noise and distractions, making sure that individuals can work flexibly, so if they need to take more brain breaks or if they need to work, come in later and work later. So I think, you know, we've got this mindset that people need to be in the office working in the allotted times. And what we know from neuroscience research, but we also know from neurodivergent research, is that different brains need different things and operate differently. And if that means I need to work late at night because that serves my brain better, then I really should be, as an adult, allowed to work that way. And I should be trusted to do that. And that's not always the case. And it goes both ways. But it also could come down to the different types of lighting that you might need.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it. And it's working at how this all comes together is really the big piece. Sorry, I've got Bailey, who regularly guest appears in my podcast, going off in the background. Working out how to bring that together, and it really requires that really strong communication piece from both parties, because I can understand how employers struggle to get their head around working differently by way of that level of flexibility, and maybe they've had a bad experience, who knows, of, you know, that being abused. And so that's a complexity to be managed. But I guess from the employee side, what would be your advice to someone in how to advocate for, say, they identify that I work better at night, even though the rest of this business operates, you know, 9 to 5? How could they be advocating for themselves and still demonstrating that they're going to meet the business needs for their role?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, that's a great question. I think the first thing is that they need to have an environment or a trust relationship with their manager or their HR team that they can talk to about their specific needs. A lot of what comes with being neurodivergent in a very neurotypical world is that often we've had to create workarounds or masking, or, you know, where we're kind of working internally at a rate of knots just to manage ourselves in a way that feels appropriate in, you know, this kind of environment. And so when you can be yourself at work, you're going to be actually much more effective. In terms of advocating, if you've got that trust, being able to talk to your manager and say, look, I have been diagnosed with ADHD or autism spectrum. These are some of the things that I'm, you know, struggling with. And these are the kind of ways that I could, that if you can provide me flexibility with, I can be much more effective. You know, can we give this a trial so that, you know, you can see that I can still maintain my work, but, you know, we're building trust in this new situation. Again, you know, as long as you've got that trust, that can sometimes be a very difficult conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that might be a conversation that you build to over time. And I guess also, it sort of gets back to when you're first seeking a job, understanding the values of that organization, which probably then first, though, before you even get to that point, is understanding yourself, right, and understanding what it is that you need.
Absolutely. And if you don't yet have a diagnosis, or, you know, you're in that process, you may not even know that you have a neurodivergent brain that, you know, requires more flexibility. And maybe you've been struggling for quite a while, kind of going, well, I don't understand why this is so difficult. And that's often the case for certainly a lot of women of kind of my age group who were kind of late diagnosed. Just, you know, the diagnosis just wasn't available. It wasn't a girl and women thing. It was just a boy and men thing back when I was going to school.
Hey, Alex here. Just wanted to reach out to everyone and say thank you so much for following along with the Brand My Career podcast. I'm really loving having the conversations that I'm having and bringing this content to people. I want to keep bringing more content to people. I want to bring stories of people's career journey. And one of the ways that I can be doing that is by getting your support. And one of the ways you can do that is by shouting me a coffee. On my website, you can find the link to shout me a coffee to help me keep bringing more content, building what I'm already have done and improving it, getting better, getting more and more people on and sharing their career stories and the lessons that they've learned along the way. So thank you for following along, and would you consider getting on board and helping me take it to new heights?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Which is interesting, this thinking through the barriers for people getting a diagnosis. What would you advise to someone that's maybe starting to think, oh, maybe I need to look into this and I want to get some answers, and maybe I want to find out, well, am I ADHD or am I neurodivergent? Like, where would someone start with that, and how could they approach that in a productive way?
Yeah, look, the most typical route is through your GP, because you will need a referral to a specialist. The challenging thing for anyone going through a diagnosis process is the time it takes to actually get on the list, and then through that list process and then into the diagnosis. So that could take months. I was very lucky. It only took me 6 weeks. But I've heard of, you know, 6, 12, 18-month waiting lists. So, you know, that's always a challenge. The second challenge is that, you know, often we are we're working with professionals that will only do one diagnosis at once. So, you know, for anyone with autism spectrum, there's a high percentage of those people with ASD who will also have ADHD, but they don't, they're not ever diagnosed together. You go down one track and then you'll go back and go down another track to be diagnosed. So, you know, it could be quite a lengthy process. I think self-diagnosis is great if that is helping you establish some routines, making some changes that help you feel like you're getting a handle on it. But I am very pro having that formal diagnosis so that I know categorically that's what I'm playing with. Yeah, and that just helps you get to a point where you go, okay, now I understand it. Now I can start to, you know, research what's going to work for me, start the healing process, or whatever it might be, or asking for accommodations at work.
Yeah, because particularly if you're trying to, and that trust piece, like you've got to trust the employer, but the employer needs to trust you as well. And I guess it'd be particularly if you're sort of self-diagnosing yourself and then using that in a, maybe a potential leveraging conversation with an employer to get a certain structure that you're after, that I guess could be perceived regardless, like it might very well be correct and it might very well be what's best for you, but you'd maybe just want to frame it correctly, making sure that you're not sort of manipulating the conversation based on a self-diagnosis versus if you've got a formal diagnosis, you can probably be a bit more upfront around this is the diagnosis I have and that's why I need met versus if it's a self-diagnosis, maybe you just reframe it a little bit to around this is how I best operate, this is my ask, this is why I think it's going to be a benefit for me and for you, and just being appropriate in how you frame that conversation.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, my personal take on that is, you know, there's a couple of options. So one is, you know, when you've got a formal diagnosis, it's easier to have the conversation. I've just been formally diagnosed. Here's kind of what I need. This is what I'm struggling with. And, you know, that becomes a formal request, which is really about psychosocial safety, right? I might need to have some changes made. And as a business, you know, you're obligated to take on as is reasonably fair, my request. When you're coming to the conversation without a formal diagnosis, maybe the framing is, look, this is kind of what I feel is challenging me at the moment. I am seeking a formal diagnosis, but I'm wondering if we can just make some tweaks that might help me in the meantime. You know, would you be okay to trial that? You know, the issue for a lot of neurodivergent conditions is that you don't always see them, right? They're in the brain. And so it's not like a tic disorder where you can see often a physical manifestation of that neurodevelopmental condition. For, you know, people with ASD or ADHD, there might not be a physical manifestation. Now, if somebody comes to you and says, I have anxiety or depression, or this is what I'm going through, or I've broken my leg, you make accommodations. This should be no different. So it's very much an education piece. And we're in the early parts of that journey in corporate life.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And we're all just working through it together. And it's trying to avoid any one particular group having to wear all the burden. It's like wherever possible, it's like I'm a big believer in self-advocation and that's an important part of career progression and managing your career, is that you do need to self-advocate. You do need to make it known what you want. You can't just assume people are going to know it and care about it. I'm, you know, always saying like no one cares more about your career than you. And you can't outsource that responsibility to anyone. But on the flip side, of course, you need employers that have been proactively trying to find ways to accommodate their workforce and all of that, and not just leaving it to you and sort of just going, oh, well, you never said anything, and having no care at all. So, yeah, wherever you can learn to bring that all together, I think is really cool. So I also know that you're really passionate about supporting women in their career. And that one of the things that you noticed that was that maybe women were less likely to sort of be speaking up about what it is that, that they want. How have you sort of tried to engage in that space, and what are the barriers there? What are the challenges and what are the opportunities, do you think?
I think what has made it challenging for women, and not all women, but it is quite a common occurrence that, you know, we've worked for a lot of years in very male-dominated corporate environments, and what I've found as a trend, and I've noticed it for myself, is that, you know, we'll often look at a job spec and say, actually, we don't have all of those things, or, you know, we're not really ready for it, and so we don't apply for the job, we don't put ourselves forward. Rather than saying, look, I've got 70%, but I'm going to have a go, and, you know, here's what I need from you to support me in this step up. So I definitely think that's been part of the female psyche, for want of a better word. I do think that's slightly changing, and I think what can really help that is, A, being really clear on, you know, what you bring to any organization. What are your strengths? What are your values? What are your aspirations? You know, what are the skills and capabilities that you've got that'll help you in stepping into the next role? But I also think there's got to be a better focus for women on nurturing relationships, not only in a broader network sense, but also internally with different types of leaders, creating mentoring discussions, career sponsorship discussions. I think that can be really powerful, because often there are talent conversations going on and you're not in the room and no one is advocating for you. And so the broader you can be with your relationships, the potential for other people to advocate for you is going to be higher.
Mm.
So I think those are kind of some really important things for women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen the series Mad Men?
Yeah.
We were watching it, and it kind of like this shines a light on that in a real, like, blaringly obvious way. And when you can sort of see the roots of that sort of culture of, you know, like, you know, it's a agency, all the only women in the office are the sort of admin support, and there's no female writers and all of this stuff. And then one girl sort of works her way up and she proves herself and surely pushes against status quo, gets herself in. But then she, you know, she's in at the office, and then they rock up for the meeting that she thinks they're going to make all the decisions, and all the decisions were made the night before at the strip club and all this. And she's like, why wasn't I part of this? And I'm like, oh, well, you wouldn't want to be there and all this. And, oh, you know, and it was just constantly missing out on those discussions because it's all getting done around the boys' club, you know, down at the bar and all this sort of stuff. And it's just interesting how the roots of that historical stuff often continue, but it's almost in a it almost becomes more dangerous when it's less obvious and starts to just creep into, maybe there's this policies and stuff that have always been there, or just little ways of doing things that don't appear necessarily to be sexist or discrediting someone or excluding someone, but there's these little things that just sort of flow through, and it's just how things are done, and it's kind of can be trickier to navigate when it's a bit less obvious and someone's maybe not intentionally trying to exclude someone or make it harder for someone, but it's deeply rooted.
Yeah, and I heard a great example the other day of a talent review that was going on, and there was a lady who'd just come back from maternity leave, you know, probably a 15-month-old baby, and just come back from maternity leave, and there was an opportunity for a promotion. And the question was raised, it's probably not appropriate for her to have that promotion yet because she's got a baby and she won't want to travel. Now, that's in that moment, you're making assumptions about that woman's situation. I mean, she could be the breadwinner. She could be, the career hound. And so I think that the safest option is always to ask questions rather than make statements. But this has been a mindset that's been in place for a long time, you know, multiple hundreds of years. So, you know, we're getting there, but very, very slowly.
And, yeah, like you said there, like you can, because I guess if you're trying to, like, challenge cultures and things, like you can do that in a way that maybe is going to create less pushback, can't you? Like instead of challenging employer on, you know, are you being sexist, you can say, well, are we making assumptions, you know, about anyone and anything? Because it's like everything will be better if we stopped making assumptions and actually made good sound decisions and Absolutely. Didn't eliminate options before they even arise and things like that. So it's an interesting space to try and navigate.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the challenge is we're only just starting to measure, you know, really women in leadership and diversity of women in organisations. It's been in the reporting for a while, but what you report on and you measure, you'll focus on. And you know, where that's not available or it's not a requirement, then it perhaps isn't a priority. And then are you just placating? Are you just going, well, it's reporting for reporting's sake, rather than we're actually going to actively seek out a diverse workforce, because actually the research and the benefits around a diverse workforce are amazing in terms of innovation and creation and collaboration. But, you know, really it's down to that leadership team and the executive thinking and the board. And so we need more women on boards, more diversity of boards, fish rots from the head. So, we need a good fish head.
I'm a big believer that culture drives more change than KPIs. Though I do think KPIs and targets have their place, but they'll never replace and be more effective than culture. And so you need the culture in place that genuinely values diverse perspectives. And then from that, they set a target rather than, we have to set a target and we're going to try it. Even if they try to meet that target, it's not going to have the same impact as if the culture is being driven from that genuine motive.
And I think that's absolutely right, because, you know, if you've built a culture purposefully as opposed to it just being allowed to develop, that genuinely rewards and celebrates diversity and safety and thinking and expression, and then absolutely that will outweigh any sort of KPIs that you can put in place, for sure.
So when you're coaching people, what's your typical focus of how you sort of drive that process?
It's obviously very tailored to the individual's goals, but, you know, generally what I find is a trend with my clients at the moment is that something has happened. There's been a change or a situation that's occurred that's, you know, created a dynamic for them that's meant, right, I've got to do something about it. I've been dealing with this for a while. And as is, you know, typically what happens when you know, change is required, you know, it's the pain of staying where you are versus the promise of where you want to go. And so typically with the women and men that I work with, you know, they're dealing with underlying feelings of I'm not good enough, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I feel overwhelmed and fatigued all the time. You know, I don't feel like I'm advocating for myself. I've got a number of women that I work with that have an ADHD brain. And so you're then overlaying the emotional dysregulation, and that obviously then can turn quite minor situations into things that are requiring or having a lot of time spent ruminating. And so we really focus on what are the kind of key fundamentals you need around that help you manage your well-being. You know, what are your non-negotiables? And when you get to a stage in your work life where you are fatigued and overwhelmed and, you know, on the brink of burnout, chances are you have neglected, for whatever reason, your well-being, your boundaries, your values, and you've focused all your energy on the thing that makes you stress. So we really kind of tear it all back in a really lovely and constructive way. And we really focus on, let's get clear on who you are and who you want to be when you're at your best. And what is it going to take to actually do that? What are the small incremental steps that you need to be taking every day that support you to turn up as your best? There's a lot of rewiring around these sort of negative, I call them bullshit beliefs. And they are, you know, well-entrenched statements that we use with ourselves, which are, oh, that was rubbish, or, you know, I know that I'll never be able to get to that level, or, you know, so these are these statements that just kind of circulate and are incredibly unhelpful and really stifling. And so we really set about reframing those and really trying to install that sort of growth mindset. And we work on strengths. You know, what are your strengths? So you're sitting there and you're telling me you're not good enough or you're failing, but actually let's look at where you've been successful. And once you start to draw that out and you combine that with, you know, a deeper understanding of what their strengths are, and then you go back out to your network and look for more evidence, it's amazing how, you know, that really just helps to prepare people for another step, you know, whether that's a step to another organization or a step into a different type of role or a step up. So preparing yourself mentally for that career move. And also, you know, what's the kind of organization I want to work for? We spend a lot of time at work. We want to make sure that the organization is right for us. And, you know, when you're going into an organization is the best time to get really clear on what are my boundaries, what are my values, what are my non-negotiables, what will I tolerate? How do I want to lead? You know, you've got a fresh start. And so being able to set yourself up in that way is so powerful, so powerful.
I was just listening the other day, like on that self-limiting beliefs piece, someone was talking about the technique of like inserting your name into these like comments that we say to ourselves, because everyone knows, like, you would never speak to anyone else the way we talk to ourselves. And I remember I was thinking about it once, going, man, I wonder how many people you would make cry in a day if you spoke to them the way you talk to yourself, you know? Like, but then, yeah, that little technique of inserting your name into those comments, and then it sort of allows it to reflect back at yourself, like I'm not any of this stuff. Like, I'm not a piece of crap, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. And we can be so mean. Yeah. No, nobody is as mean as we are to ourselves. It's horrifying, horrifying. And that's where you've got to, everything we do is about creating intention until it becomes a habit. And, you know, when you've had that operating system installed for so long, you've got to be so intentional about rewiring those mental habits and that mindset. And that's where things like journaling can really help, and a gratitude practice. And the other one that I really love is that sort of self-reflection practice, you know, learning loop, where you come out of a meeting and go, what did I do really well? What will I do differently next time? You know, and I think that's powerful, because that's about acknowledging firstly what you do really well. It's very often we don't do that. We only just focus on the negative, and that's because the brain is wired that way.
Yeah, and you don't have to do it alone, do you? Like, even me and my wife Melissa at times, like, so if she's like had a bad day, or if something particularly triggering happened and she's just sort of really caught up in it, she might even ask me, hey, can you help me do this reframing exercise? She's got an exercise that she does if she really wants to reframe something. But if it's, you know, really raw in the moment, like, we might do it together, and we'll sit down and we'll chat through, and it's like, yeah, all right, so this is what I'm feeling. This is why. But then you sort of go, but it does the evidence stack up for that? And you sort of go, but I've done X and Y, or I've achieved this, you know, whatever it might be. And you can sort of work through. And then by the end of it, you've got it all down, you've externalized that, you've read it back, and then you can actually quite quickly move on from something that was feeling really highly emotional, you know, just 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah, and I think that's such a great exercise. Again, if you are prone to anxious thoughts, you know, you'll probably spend a lot of time in rumination. And when it's up there circling in your head, you know, it kind of keeps going on a loop. And it's not until you either talk it out or you write it down and you're actually looking at it that, you know, A, it gets out of your head, and secondly, you can look at it and really kind of delve into, is this right? So that's that constant challenging of our thinking and our, you know, our words and our thoughts. It all counts. You know, it's like saying to yourself every morning, God, I'm so stressed. It's one thing to acknowledge the stress and then do something about it, but if you're getting up every day and go, God, I'm so stressed, and you're not doing anything about it, then you will continue to be stressed. You're just reinforcing that pattern in your brain.
This goes to show, when it comes to career progression, this the more holistic perspective you can have on it, the better, right? Because it's our whole person that's trying to build that career and perform in that job and show up to that workplace. And our well-being, our mindset, it all feeds into it, and both ways, you know, the way we're showing up at work helps us show up at home.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got this kind of personal philosophy around, you know, the work that organizations do from a leadership and development and culture perspective is really important, because it actually impacts more broadly on families and communities, and so there's quite a big responsibility there, which I don't know that we really speak about. You know, the more work that they can do to create really constructive environments, and I mean, that translates beautifully to home and relationships and kids and communities, and
absolutely. Like, right. You know, emotional intelligence, that's very much something that you might learn through your career that you can then take back to your family life and show up better as a better husband, or as a better wife, or a better son or grandchild or supporter and carer and all of these things. Absolutely. And particularly, I think, for younger generations entering the workforce, you know, it can be a great place that you learn a whole lot of life lessons. And when you get a really good boss and mentor, they, you know, they can really set you up for life. And I know for me, a big thing was always football. And I've had some coaches growing up through my life that have, you know, been, you know, massive influences on who I've become as a man, that's then flowed into relationships, flowed into my career, you know, your work ethic, your, the way you show up, the way you work in the team and all this stuff. So, yeah, it all flows together. And whenever we sort of create these silos of you've got your career and you've got your family and, you know, all these siloed things, but then we're showing up as a person throughout it all and it all comes with us. And we, yeah. What's the saying? You know, wherever you go, like you'll find yourself sort of thing. Like,
yeah. You'll be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you've ever worked in a toxic work environment, that impacts every aspect of your life. So they are inextricably linked, even though, you know, when we're building organizational cultures, we're not thinking more broadly about, you know, how do we want our employees to feel? How do we want them to... you know, what do we want them to believe about coming to work, to think about coming to work, to how do we want them to act, etc. You know, when you've got toxic work environments, you're not, no one's thinking about that. They don't care.
Hmm.
But that impacts every part of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Julie, thank you so much for a really great chat. How can people find you and get in touch?
Look, probably the easiest way is through LinkedIn. It's pretty simple, so it's Julie Cockerell. You can also get in touch with me through the website, which is juliecockerell.au. So they're probably the two best ways to do that, to reach out. Wonderful. Always open to a coffee chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll put all of that in the show notes, and thanks Lovely. For coming on.
Thank you. Thanks, Alex. I've really appreciated it. Loved the conversation. I mean, we could talk for hours on this stuff.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And let's connect on LinkedIn so that we can keep the conversation going. Or head to my website and download my free resource, The Career Building Principles. Bye for now.